From 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, it's The Bill. Conversations with entrepreneurs and innovators about their dreams, their triumphs, and their challenges.
Giving. Americans give more than $400 billion to charities every year. And yet, most nonprofit organizations rely on impulse donations for much of their funding. Until recently, it was hard to process donations of 5, 10, or 20 bucks online without running into expensive implementation and security hurdles. Today's guest has been working on a solution to that challenge. He spent more than 2 decades in the military and as a counterterrorism policy director before shifting gears and joining his first startup. And as John Gossert was negotiating the sale of that company, he met a new co-founder with a vision for a social media tool that makes donating to charity as easy as posting a hashtag. And if that sounds too easy to be true, John's here to remind us all that launching a company, even one with the intention of changing the world for the better, comes with challenges you can't always solve with hustle alone. It's the story of Good World, coming up next on The Build.
The Build is made possible with support from 2820 Press, providing business consulting and content strategy services to customer-obsessed companies nationwide. More information at 2820press.com.
It's The Build. I'm Joe Taylor Jr., joined today by John Gossert at Good World. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
My pleasure. Give us a little rundown. I think that you have one of the more interesting LinkedIn pages that I think I've ever seen. Big transition from military life into civilian life and entrepreneurship. Run down the journey for us that folks can understand.
I started out trying to go to Boston College and get my undergraduate degree, and I didn't have the money to do that. And so I looked at a lot of potential scholarships and grants and things like that, and it was the military that was offering me the most. I didn't know anything. I couldn't spell Army, but I applied for and got an Army ROTC scholarship, which afforded me a 4-year scholarship, way to get my undergraduate degree. I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. It certainly wasn't a military career, and I fully intended to serve the 4 years that I owed to pay back the scholarship. And I just, I never got out. By the time that time came, I was already in Europe and I was already into my second tour as an Army officer. And I ended up doing about 22 and a half years in military and government. I kind of transitioned over to the counterterrorism policy side in the last 6 or 7 years of my career. And I just ended up, making a career of that. And so I was all over the world. I was spending most of my time at the end of my career in places like Pakistan and Yemen and East Africa. But mid-career, I'd been afforded the opportunity to go to grad school at Georgetown and to teach at West Point. And there was a handful of guys that I met there that were like-minded that reached out to me as they were getting out of the military. They had an idea, and it became Ride Scout. I didn't really know too much about entrepreneurship or tech. I was working with some of the most bleeding-edge technology in the world in my day job. In the counterterrorism world, but my personal phone was a flip phone. But these guys reached out to me at a time that I had been away from home for, the better part of a decade. My sons were getting older, high school and college age, and I thought maybe, this would be a good time for a transition. So I joined these guys, figuring that like most of these ventures, it would fail in 6 months or so. It would give me time to figure out what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. We raised a couple of $1 million, and we ended up selling that company, getting acquired by Daimler Mercedes. So my foray into the entrepreneurial space and the tech space was actually kind of incidental and in many ways accidental.
Now, the exit, for most folks, they go through a journey like that. They exit, they take a little time away, they think about maybe doing some VC, or they just kind of head out to early retirement. You dive right back in with Good World. So tell us a little bit about Good World, the mission, what attracted you to the idea, and how are you executing on that?
So Good World was the other half of the founding team, Dale Pfeiffer, was her original idea and vision. And as we were going through what would become diligence with, you know, the German bankers for the acquisition of my last company, I had been advised, I'd met Dale in Washington, D.C., kind of in similar entrepreneurial circles. And she had this great idea, but she didn't have any corporate governance or, you know, no financial instrument on. She basically had this great idea, a laptop and an intern. And so I was trying to help her think through some of the, you know, kind of foundational pieces that she needed to put together to, you know, to make it a company. You know, here are 10 things that you need to do and kind of in the order that I think you need to do these things. And she and I became close. And, you know, the more that I advised her and we had these kind of sessions that were becoming regular advisory sessions, the more that idea was getting under my skin and getting and digging into my brain. So by the time we get acquired at the end of 14, that RideScout gets acquired, I mean, I'm already thinking very hard about the implications of Good World. And I almost immediately started negotiating with Daimler on how I could, you know, exit, maintain most of my equity and my comp, but at the same time, be free to work on this other thing, which I thought was, you know, was much bigger. And it was something, to be honest, that I was much more passionate about. So what Good World does is we allow people to donation enable their social media content. So we've got thousands of charity partners, including some of the very biggest in the world, Greenpeace, PETA, Save the Children, UNICEF, UN Foundation, and thousands of, you know, dog shelters that you've never heard of, you know, and other smaller charities. But we allow them to, you know, in just a matter of a couple of minutes, connect to our technology, to our platform, and donation enable all their social content. So with a tweet or just a comment on Facebook, you can trigger an instant donation and also instant engagement, because, you know, when you comment hashtag donate, you know, to Save the Children, you say hashtag donate 10 on any one of their posts right now, you'll get a Facebook reply back from Save the Children. It's our technology, but it's their social media saying, you know, thanks for your donation. Credit card, debit cards being swiped. The money's being batched in ACH directly to the charity. You got a customized email receipt coming your way. Donor and nonprofit dashboards being dynamically updated, you know, data dashboards, CRM integration, you know, the whole works. So, you know, the fundamental premise of Good World, and of course this has implications for payments writ large, not just, you know, donations, think political contributions, university donations, and commerce, you know, ultimately, which is why very soon we're going to be announcing kind of a new step in our partnership with MasterCard. And in fact, by the time this airs, we'll have made that announcement about a strategic investment from MasterCard. So, you know, this has implications that that could run pretty deep across commerce, because it's true social payments, which nobody else is doing right now. The payments industry right now is trying to figure out if everyone's getting inspired on social and mobile to make consumption choices, how can we redirect them to a place where they can have a secure transaction, you know, which is typically like a website or a web form. And we just think that premise is fundamentally flawed. Why not allow people to have a secure payment experience at the moment they're inspired, you know, inside the content that inspired them? And in many cases, that's inside your Facebook newsfeed or inside your, you know, your Twitter stream or your Instagram feed. And don't redirect them at all. And so that's what we've done. Knock on wood, you know, nobody else is doing it right now. So we got a little bit of first mover advantage. We got some great strategic partnerships with, you know, people like MasterCard and PayPal and Twitter itself. We got a little special permission from Facebook to do what we do. We got thousands of charity partners, and you know, we're on the move. We're moving fast.
I think you're bumping up into some pretty big potential competitors. I can think that some of the social media platforms themselves may want to get into this space. And then even the payment platforms that are customized for the nonprofit community, there is a big industry behind supporting nonprofits. So how does a startup like Good World navigate that space in such a way that you can grow and thrive and not necessarily just get stomped out by a potential bigger competitor?
I mean, not to be flippant, but how we navigate that is very carefully, especially before we had institutional capital behind us. We're very fortunate to have some of the best institutional capital partners in the world. NICA partners led our first institutional rounds right out the gate, you know, and they've got you know, a lot of LPs that are part of a lot of very big fintech, PayPal and eBay and Google Payments and many others. So I think we're very fortunate that we have good, big fintech names, brothers, kind of benefactors and capital around us that help us with the expertise to navigate, but also with the network to navigate and the understanding, the institutional expertise to understand that, you know, opportunities as well as risks, a lot of times they foment in the same types of entity. So for us, you know, we could, if we didn't manage our own narrative well, we could look like a threat to all of those entities that you talked about, the platforms themselves, certainly the fintech or payments facilitation space, you know, just the nonprofit space, you know, in general, CRM managers, you name it, content providers even. We could represent a threat, but for all of those entities, we could also represent a great opportunity to differentiate an offering with your competitors. And that's really when we came out of beta. You know, we had done a few million in transactions. We had tens of thousands of unique payers. It was enough data for us to really dig into the 1.0, figure out how to get better product market fit. But one of the things that jumped out at us was just the CPAs of acquiring our own customers were a little high. And the time it was taking us to grow at a rate that we needed to maintain the first mover average and to become sustainable and become profitable, you know, that the physics wasn't working there. So we made a deliberate decision to lock arms with these, a lot of these sectors that you're talking about, to lock arms with important strategic corporates like MasterCard and PayPal and Twitter and say, you know, let's work together. We'll give you a technology that can help improve your offering and differentiate you in some ways from your competition. And in exchange, we get access to a massive distribution network that you already own. And so it resonated with a lot of strategic corporates. You know, Facebook, they like us because we help people stay on Facebook. So in a way, you know, it's a bit of a mutually beneficial arrangement there. And with these other corporates, it's about giving them something that they can offer to their customers that they don't have and that their competitors don't have.
And I can empathize with someone who's a campaign manager at a nonprofit because I can envision choosing GoodWorld as a preferred social media donation platform means I'm managing one account, one relationship, and I'm not having to set up at Twitter, at Facebook, at Instagram, and think that, oh, now I have to manage all of these separate accounts.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. But also, if you do try to do it separately, most of those tools are still going to require that redirect. And I think the most fundamental experiential difference with GoodWorld is that it's truly at the moment of inspiration, in stream, you're turning that sentiment, you know, that hashtag into an action word. I mean, you're turning it into an actual transaction, sentiment into a transaction. And nobody else is doing that right now. Facebook's got a tool now that certainly keeps you on Facebook and can keep you inside a campaign page, but nobody is allowing you to transact right inside a public newsfeed. So think of a Venmo experience, but Venmo is still kind of a private network. They're asking you, we love those guys, by the way, but Venmo is saying, let's take this conversation to a different social network. And the social network's built all around payments. And we just don't think payments are fun enough to deserve their own social network. That conversation started on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. So if we've been inspired to make a consumption choice there, whether it's to donate to a charity, make a peer-to-peer payment or buy a pair of shoes, why not allow people to make that transaction in the place where they're inspired? And that's on the platform. So that's our true differentiator. That's we call it contextual. We're portable, exportable, and contextual. And the contextual piece is one of the most important parts because if you want true social payments, you know, there's nothing social about filling out a web form. Like that's a very lonely experience. But, you know, if, let's say you don't follow Save the Children, but you and I are Facebook friends. When I comment hashtag donate25 on a Save the Children post, you're very likely now, or much more likely, to see that content that Save the Children didn't even pay to boost because you and I are friends. You're very unlikely to see that content, even if you follow Save the Children and they just boost it and they're trying to get that content to you from a commercial perspective or from a sponsored post perspective. So now you're seeing content you otherwise wouldn't have seen because you and I are friends, and I'm a much more credible ambassador for the product, in this case, Save the Children, because you know me. When you see your friends do something, it's much more likely to influence your behavior than, you know, if you're just getting served, you know, a sponsored post.
So what's the user experience for someone that sees, if we're Facebook friends, I see you say hashtag donate 25. And I see that happening. Am I asking you what's that about? Or if I try and do that, but I haven't signed up for Good World yet, what happens? What brings me over into the realm of signing up for an account and actually transacting?
Right. So it's that first conversion that's always the challenge, right? Because we are going to need to get a payment credential. So if you said hashtag donate, you know, 10, or if you retweeted, you know, my hashtag donate tweet, you would get a tweet or a Facebook reply to your comment back that instead of saying thanks for your donation, Joe, it would say thanks for your pledge. You know, thanks for your $10 pledge or your $25 pledge. And there'd be a bit.ly or a little short link that would take you to the place to complete that donation. You know, it's a click here to complete your donation. But when you land, and the one time that we will ever ask you to redirect from a Good World platform perspective, you don't have to put your name in, your email address, social media handles. We have all that because you gave that to Facebook and Twitter. So we get that through the APIs that we're connected to. And the only thing you need to put in is your credit card and expiration date. And that's why on Facebook, our conversion rate is about 61%. So it's way outside market. Then once you've done that, you can hashtag donate across any social media platform, across any of our thousands of charity partners. So of course, repeat donations on social are going to be, you know, near 100% conversion. You'd have to physically go into your dashboard and cancel it, you know, for that to walk back that donation. So conversion rates are very high. The whole point is getting you past that one small conversion hurdle, and then, you know, and then you're off and running. I mean, we want people making emotive decisions about donating to causes they're passionate about. You know, if you have a couple of beers and you you know, make a couple of drunk donations because the content speaks to you, then all the better.
Well, I think that's the other interesting thing, because it's always a challenge for nonprofits to build enough of that trust to get that impulse donation. How are you seeing folks use Good World as a platform to learn about other causes? Once they're registered once, that payment credential is essentially good across all of the charities you work with, right?
That's true. Not just all the charities we work with, but, you know, whatever platforms they're connected to. So it's, you know, it's ubiquitous. That's what we mean when we say we're portable. So it's not just a Facebook tool, a Twitter tool, or a web tool, Instagram tool. It's a you tool. Once you empower yourself and whatever that payment credential, that credit card or debit card, with the power to hashtag donate, you have that with you wherever you go, whether you're on mobile, whether you're on desktop, whatever platform, and whatever nonprofit. Now, nonprofits probably aren't in the business of, you know, touting another nonprofit, especially if it's in the same kind of issue space as them, like, hey, check out these guys, because they see that maybe as some opportunity cost. But we certainly do see some cross-pollination. I would say our biggest data pool would probably be people that donate and make repeat donations to the cause that introduced them to the technology in the first place. You know, it's very much the cause in front and Good World in support, as opposed to the Good World brand being out in front. But then the next biggest pool is probably people that stay in the same space. So they're given to, you know, a couple of different dog rescues, maybe based on breed or, I don't know, geography. We see that same type of pooling with poverty or hunger types of charities. But for the most part, I would say the biggest, you know, the mode in this case would probably be people that are got introduced to technology in a particular cause or charity, and they're kind of sticking with that charity, and they've got that relationship with that charity.
So whenever I see a new vehicle that includes payments, I immediately get concerned about the potential for fraud or misuse. How do you keep bad actors off your platform?
Well, we do a lot of vetting, both, you know, from a human perspective as well as from an automated perspective. On the nonprofit side, we make sure that every nonprofit that gets access to the platform, we're checking them against, the IRS database to ensure that they are, a 501c3 or 4 that's in good standing, that standing hasn't been revoked. Also that we check OFAC to make sure that there's no terrorist financing ties, and that's another treasury-based database. And all that's automated, through their EIN. As far as the people go, when they're putting their credit card in during that short onboarding process, they're actually tunneling into Stripe, which is our front-end payment processor. So we at GoodWorld never touch the credit card, and we actually never touch the money. It goes straight from the swipe through Stripe as a processor, and then to the coffers of our nonprofit partner. So that helps us, protect maybe the most sensitive data, payment credentials, and the banking information for our nonprofit partners, because technically we don't have that information. We use a tokenized vault to process those transactions. But I think the other thing is that you could walk away from your laptop or from your phone, logged into an Amazon or logged into GoodWorld. I can't imagine that, there'd be some big nefarious action around, donating to Save the Children on your behalf, Joe. But if somebody did want to do that, we also make sure that our donors are ultimately in charge of their credentials and of their ability to hashtag donate. Within 12 hours, you can always go on your own, into your own dashboard in GoodWorld, and you can cancel a donation or you can edit the amount. If you say hashtag donate 1,000 and you meant to say hashtag donate 10 or 100, we don't want to say gotcha and there's nothing you can do, you can go in there and edit that yourself. So we're trying to breed trust in those ways too, to let people have access to their data, access to their accounts, and even make changes if they make mistakes. Or if somebody, were to donate on your behalf, like your kid picks up your phone and hashtag donates $10,000 to Greenpeace, you're going to get that email. You're going to get the badge on your Facebook app is going to light up. Somebody's talking about you. Of course, this is Greenpeace saying thanks for your $10,000 donation. So you're going to get notified in a lot of ways that just happened. And then you can easily go in there and correct it inside 12 hours. If 12 hours expires, we'll go in and do the manual refund.
Oh, sure. And I think that's a huge advantage. I know from my own, the first half of my career was spent in the nonprofit space. And I know the fact that you can ride on top of the existing credit card processing platforms means that you are backed up for things like chargebacks or potential fraud. The thing that strikes me on your pricing page is that from a nonprofit point of view, 7% of a transaction for a new donor is a bargain. If you ask any kind of nonprofit fundraiser, most of the services or folks that are out there doing rainmaking for nonprofits are charging significantly more, often in the realm of 20 to 25%. So 7% is a pretty good bargain. You're basically riding your fee on top of those Stripe fees. So the opportunity to grow your platform is basically just a matter of scaling donations in general. So tell me a little bit about how you've scaled so far from launch. What are the aspects of the team members that you recruit to be able to make this transition from just a couple of folks with a startup to a team of over a dozen really growing this platform?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some learning that went on in our almost 2-year beta period. And, to be honest, there's learning that's still going on. I think in some ways we grew too quickly. I knew that we needed to build both sides of the market relatively quickly, just so we had enough data points that the observations that we were making could be made in a rigorous way that we could actually, put more faith and resources behind. I didn't want 50 beta users running around donating to 2 charities and try to somehow extrapolate, human behavior from that, because there's not enough data there. So we hired, a decent sized sales team, a CS team, communications, marketing, so that we could build up you know, I wanted about 10,000, I thought, unique payers or unique donors. We originally set a goal of about 1,000 nonprofits. The nonprofits came on more quickly than we anticipated. So, you know, we bumped that up, you know, very quickly, that goal to 1,500. We ended up, you know, at about 2,500 during the heart of the beta. And then the users kind of came at us in waves. As you know, it's a seasonal, giving is kind of a seasonal thing. There was some frustration around getting nonprofits to activate because it was really a B2B2C play. So we were constantly dialing, you know, up marketing and incentives, two-sided referral credits, you know, things like that to incentivize that behavior. And there was a lot of learning. I mean, we were probably, you know, another 7 or 8 people strong at the height of it. And I think I realized that it was important at the time to build up those two sides of the market. But then once we started automating our CS, you know, through tools like Intercom and bots, and we really fleshed out the dashboard so that donors and nonprofits could do 99% of the things that they would ask us to do, they can do them themselves, which is great for us from a labor and efficiency perspective and a cost perspective, but it's also great for them because it breeds that trust. I don't have to wait to get a hold of somebody at Good World to make this change to my account. I can go in there and just do it myself, get that confirmation, it's effective immediately. So as we started automating a lot of these processes and systems, we realized that, you know, a lot of these people that, you know, unfortunately weren't even paying for themselves at the time, now were becoming redundant. And so, you know, we scale back to try to extend that burn, you know, like you're always trying to do until you can turn the corner and be self-sustaining and hit that break-even point. And I think that's where we are. 2019 is where we will hit that point. I think the MasterCard relationship is going to be an important part of that, but we're doing it with a much smaller team than we had kind of at the heart of our beta.
So shifting gears a little bit from growing a team to growing a family, you've got 4 sons. How do you make sure that the entrepreneur lifestyle doesn't keep you from you know, burning out, or how do you make sure that you're not sacrificing family time for the sake of growing the business?
I'm sure I'm sacrificing, you know, a lot of family time, and it's probably almost exclusively with my wife. So another reason that I'm fortunate, you know, when we launched Good World, I kind of had the safety net under me already. So all these people that get on, you know, shows like yours, Joe, or they speak at events and they talk about, you know, it was just this like, you know, don't know how to fail, can't quit, whether it's like veterans or just entrepreneurs in general. A lot of these guys, I think they leave out like an important facet of their story. You know, if you just listen to them and take them at face value, a lot of these guys will tell you they were just like working really hard and one day they turned the corner. There's usually some timing, some fortuitous timing in there. And for me, there was a lot of it in a bunch of different places. One is we had already sold Ride Scout. So I was at a point in my life where my kids were going to college, and all of a sudden all that was taken care of. So I was afforded the opportunity to take some risk. I also have, you know, significant disability and a decent pension from my 22 and a half years as an Army officer, which allowed me to be able to work for, you know, a little bit less or at times nothing, which other people maybe aren't afforded the ability to do. And then with my kids, with my family, it was the same thing. You know, we started very early. So by the time I'm making the jump into the entrepreneurial space, my kids are high school and college age. At this point now, I've got 3 kids in college, 1 graduated from college. So and the 3 are in Boston. So, you know, I come home, there's no kids in this house and haven't been for some time. So it affords me the time to dedicate, you know, with the exception of my wife, who I could probably spend a lot more time with. I think we would both agree.
and now we're both on the record because I know my wife gives me that feedback often as well. And I'm sure they're both listening. What in wrapping up, what haven't I asked you that is an important key part of the Good World story that you want to make sure our listeners hear?
Every entrepreneur, I don't know. I don't think it's just about Good World. I think it's in general. I've become a pretty astute observer of behaviors because I had to have been in my old careers. But on the entrepreneur side, on the capital side, on the strategic partner side. And I just find myself, frustrated a lot, because I think that a lot of people under the auspices of "I'm giving you advice" are telling you things that sound good, and they say, and they're buzzy and they make sense. They could go on a poster, but that's not what these guys are doing. So kind of back to my last point, where people are telling you that it's just hard work put us over the edge. You're like, no, you didn't tell us about this one very fortuitous incident. And those things are going to be there. So I would say, number one, you're any successful venture, you're going to have the night like we had at Ride Scout, sitting around the table where we had $719 in the bank and we weren't going to be able to make bills at 9 o'clock in the morning, like with your back against the wall. That's going to happen. And I think that those are the stories that people should be talking more about, and about how you came back from that. In Good World, our near-death experience was a Series A term sheet that blew up when we had 5 weeks of money left in the bank. We had to walk away and we had to start over from scratch. And we had to put together a $1.5 million round, wire to wire, including closing, inside of 5 weeks, starting from scratch. Those stories are going to happen. And I think some people, when they're faced with that type of adversity, they tend to fold because they think it's something that's unusual because I obviously didn't do this right. And I'm saying that I think most successful startups, especially their first time around entrepreneurs, those things are going to happen. The other myth that I would dispel is this whole team bullshit. Team is maybe three or four, because I do some angel investing myself. Team is maybe three or four on my list. If you give me the screening criteria, which is it's got to be a real problem that addresses a sizable enough addressable market that makes it interesting from a financial perspective, you've got to have a real solution that actually solves that problem. But those are screening criteria. That's just like getting in the door criteria. When we start talking about evaluation criteria, what's going to make me want to invest in this? Team's like three or four down. It's timing. I mean, I'll go back to that point again. If you're too early, then it becomes very uninteresting. If you're too late, the market's already saturated. If you give me an average entrepreneur with a great idea and a great addressable market, we can make that work. But if you give me the most brilliant entrepreneur in the world and the timing's wrong, it's not going to work. It's not going to make it. So I would love if we had some people out there that would, you know, start talking about the things that are really keeping young entrepreneurs up at night. Not this, like, who's that guy that makes all the YouTube videos? You know what I'm talking about?
Gary Vaynerchuk?
Yeah. I mean, God bless him. He's a great orator. And I've caught myself kind of getting a little bit inspired and fired up by his words. But like, give me something beyond the abstract. Give me something like nuts and bolts that I can use. You know, I don't think there's enough of that. I wish somebody had taught me a lot of things. And so now I try to do that when I advise companies. I advise quite a few. But my sessions are not fun. My sessions are kind of roll up your sleeves and let's get to work.
I think they're fun when you're on the other side of that adversity and you realize, you know, the importance of the choice that you made. I feel like we could probably do an entire 6-episode miniseries just on that stuff, because it is true. We, especially on this show, we try to avoid what some of my colleagues call the hustle porn, right? Because if you just hustle, 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 it all works out, right? No. Like you said, try making payroll when you're 20% short one day. And that's a challenge I don't know that you get at Harvard Business School. So it's why I think it takes a very, very particular kind of person to actually survive in this kind of space. And so I think that leads me to the last question is, this being the second company that you've built hands on, is this something that continues to grow and stay independent? Or do you think that Good World finds a home as part of a bigger organization?
We're going to do what's best for Good World, right? So if we get the opportunity to bring Good World to the masses and wrap this capability and this technology and this vision around the whole world, and that requires us to remain independent longer, even if, you know, we have to wait for the rewards that might come earlier, if we would, you know, take a different path. I think we're prepared to do that. I think our investors are prepared to do that. But if the path to wrapping Good World around the world is maybe, you know, a strong strategic partnership with an entity like MasterCard or another, and that's the best path, then yeah, we're open to that. So, you know, we're open to M&A, we're open to more strategic investment, we're open to staying, you know, independent forever. But it's going to be we're not looking to cash out. We're both in position to passionately fight for this thing, this vision that we're calling Good World, and we're going to take the path that's best for that vision. And of course, our investors.
Fantastic. John Gossert, co-founder and COO of Good World. Thanks for joining us on The Build.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of The Build. Our producer is Katie Cohen-Zonizer. Our production coordinator is Nicole Hubbard. Our production team for this episode included Amelia Lohman, Jess Ryan, Faiza Samreen, Gianna Sini, and April Smith. Podfly Productions manages our post-production, and our theme music is performed by Arrows and Sound. I'm Joe Taylor Jr.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Build. We hope you'll share this series with your friends and provide us with feedback on the iTunes Store. You can also subscribe to weekly updates and learn more about upcoming guests by visiting our show page at thebuild.biz. This has been a 2820 radio production.